The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Youngkin for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues for the next half hour. I'll be reading articles from the Mayo Clinic Health Letter, and the lead article in this issue of the Mayo Clinic Health Letter is called The Future of Cancer Treatments. Cancer has been a menace to humanity and a mystery, at least in finding a cure to medical researchers since at least the time of the ancient Egyptians. But dramatic progress has been made through the years in fighting the disease so people can live longer and better. Into that history of progress enters immunotherapy. Immunotherapy is a type of treatment that uses someone's own immune system to target and attack cancer cells. The immune system continually conducts surveillance to guard against what it considers to be foreign in the body. For example, when your immune system detects harmful bacteria or a virus, it responds by mobilizing certain cells and producing specific proteins. These proteins are known as antibodies. They attack and destroy the invaders. Cancer cells are harmful, but your immune system doesn't always recognize them as such. As a result, cancer cells can sometimes multiply without restraint. Scientists have learned that if the immune system can consistently recognize cancer as foreign, you'll be able to fight it in the same way it would fight an infection. Over the last decade, research focused on immunotherapy has expanded. Now results are pointing toward promising, better-tolerated cancer treatments. The holy grail of all cancer therapies throughout the years has been to develop a treatment that targets only cancer cells and not healthy cells, says Richard Vile, Ph.D., an immunologist and cancer researcher at Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. Chimeric antigen receptor T-cell therapy, also called CAR-T cell therapy for short, is one type of immunotherapy. CAR-T cell therapy relies on genetically modified immune cells, a type of white blood cell known as T cells, to recognize and destroy cancer cells while limiting damage to healthy cells. One of the reasons chemotherapy can be so toxic and unpleasant is that it's rarely highly selective for the cancer cells, and as a result, it can harm other cells. CAR-T cell therapy, in theory, only kills cancer cells, which makes the treatment gentler on the body. Dr. Vile is leading research into genetically engineered viruses aimed at unleashing a two-pronged attack on cancer. CAR-T cell therapy is one part. The other part of this therapy, known as oncolytic virus, is designed to infect, break open, and destroy cancer cells while sparing healthy tissue. This fairly recent type of immunotherapy uses genetically modified viruses to infect and kill cancer cells. As the cancer cells die, they release substances called antigens, which activate the immune system to seek out and destroy all cancer cells expressing the same antigens. Dr. Vile's early studies have found oncolytic viruses replicating in cancer cells and cascading to kill other disease cells. That in turn triggers an immune response in which the person's T cells, stimulated by the virus, recognize and target tumors that have spread for a second wave of cancer destruction. The immune response to the oncolytic virus during that wave further activates the CAR-T cells. The Food and Drug Administration has approved CAR-T cell therapy for a number of conditions, including acute lymphoblastic leukemia, B-cell non-Hodgkin lymphoma, and multiple myeloma. CAR-T cell therapy has been an effective treatment for some forms of cancer, particularly hard-to-treat or recurrent blood cancers. One study found that 18% of people with relapsing, treatment-unresponsive chronic lymphocytic leukemia, or CLL, experienced full remission after a single CAR-T cell therapy. Another study found a response rate of 60% for people with diffuse, large B-cell lymphoma. In addition, CAR-T cell therapy has the potential to keep cancer in remission for many years. However, the therapy is not yet widely available. Financial access is also an issue. The treatments can be expensive, and not all insurers cover them. Like most cancer therapies, CAR-T cell therapy has its own side effects. Although Dr. Vial emphasizes that many side effects are well known to healthcare teams and generally reversible, side effects include cytokine release syndrome, a severe immune system reaction that can affect multiple organs in the body. Often short-term neurologic effects like confusion, seizures, and difficulty speaking or walking. Temporary blood conditions like anemia and low platelet count, and increased risk of infection. Although CAR-T cell therapy is showing promise, the field is still very young. At the moment, scientists are working to develop next-generation methods to reduce side effects, lower or even eliminate cancer recurrence, and better target treatment-resistant B-cell cancers. Most importantly, researchers are also focusing on expanding to other cancer targets, including a wider number of blood cancers as well as solid tumors. Immunotherapy has advanced hugely in recent years, says Dr. Vial. I believe future CAR-T cell treatment will involve targeting more than a single antigen in cancer cells so that cancers can't escape the treatment. Another major advancement would be understanding how we can put CAR-T cells into people so that the cells persist and keep people in remission for long periods, potentially for a person's lifetime. Finally, there also may be uses for CAR-T cell therapy aside from cancer treatment. Mayo Clinic researchers believe CAR-T cell therapy may improve treatments for autoimmune diseases, as well as prevent organ rejection in transplant recipients. And then there's a short attached article, which is about cold sore care. A cold sore is a fluid-filled blister or a group of blisters that typically develops around the lips. It's caused by the herpes simplex virus, which is typically passed from skin-to-skin contact. What should you do to manage cold sores? Well, first of all, you should stop the spread. Don't touch the sore, as that can make it worse and lead to spread. Refrain from kissing or other direct contact. Wash your hands regularly. Don't share food, beverages, towels, lip balms, or razors with others. Throw away toothbrushes you used while you had the cold sore. You should also treat it early. The non-prescription antiviral cream, Abreva, may reduce symptoms and shorten recovery time. Docosanol, which is D-O-C-O-S-A-N-O-L, is most effective if used when you first notice tingling or other early signs that indicate a cold sore is forming. Control the pain. A pain reliever like Tylenol or Advil may help. Non-prescription cold sore gels or ointments containing Benzocaine, lidocaine, or benzyl alcohol also may help relieve symptoms. Applying a cool compress or sucking on ice chips may help minimize burning or itching. Dabbing petroleum jelly on the sore and surrounding skin can help reduce any dryness and cracking. See your primary care health team or a dermatologist if a cold sore lasts for 2 weeks or keeps recurring. You may be eligible for treatment with an antiviral cream or pill. Antiviral drugs may take hours or even days off your recovery time. Triggers that may wake up the herpes simplex virus to cause cold sores include stress, becoming ill with a cold or the flu, exposure to sunlight or strong winds, changes in the immune system, or hormonal changes. Now there's a practical article in the Mayo Clinic Health Letter, which is entitled Cough and Cold Remedies. What works and what doesn't. When a cold is making you miserable, you want relief fast. Unfortunately, nothing can cure the common cold. That includes antibiotics, which treat illnesses caused by bacteria. Why is a cold so hard to treat? The common cold is not just one illness. It's a whole mess of different infections that cause the same symptoms. Even if we cure or prevent one, it's not going to stop the rest, says Jack Ohoro, MD, MPH, a Mayo Clinic infectious disease specialist. However, some prescription drugs can temporarily ease your symptoms. Here is some help understanding which non-prescription cold and cough treatments work for adults, which don't work, and which could be harmful. First, there's pain relievers. Adults can take non-prescription pain relievers like Tylenol, Advil, Motrin, and Aleve. Pain relievers might lessen the discomfort of a sore throat, headache, or fever caused by a cold. What about decongestants? Some decongestant medications like pseudoephedrine can slightly ease nasal congestion. These medications can be taken as pills, liquids, or nasal drops or sprays. Use decongestant drops or sprays up to 5 days. Using this type of spray for longer can cause rebound nasal congestion. Research also suggests that the decongestant phenylephrine is less effective at treating colds when it's taken as a liquid or a pill. Then there's chromalin sodium nasal spray. This spray may improve cold symptoms, including a runny nose, sore throat, and cough. What about dextromethorphan? This cough suppressant might provide a small benefit for adults with coughs due to the common cold. What about expectorants? Expectorants are used to help clear mucus or phlegm. Research suggests that the expectorant guaifenesin has a small benefit for adults with a cough. Then there's a group that have conflicting evidence, and more research is needed to determine if these non-prescription remedies can ease cold symptoms. The first is elderberry. Some research suggests that these supplements can shorten the length of the common cold by about 2 days and reduce the severity of cold symptoms. Then there's echinacea. Taking echinacea while you're still healthy may have a modest effect in preventing colds. Some studies show that this supplement isn't an effective cold treatment. Others show some reduction in the severity and duration of cold symptoms when taken in the early stages. Finally, there's vitamin C. Research on vitamin C is mixed, but some studies have found that regularly taking vitamin C before cold symptoms may shorten the duration of severe symptoms. Finally, there's zinc. Some evidence suggests that zinc lozenges or syrup taken within 24 hours after cold symptoms start can help shorten the length of colds. However, the Food and Drug Administration issues a warning against using nasal cold remedies containing zinc. They can cause you to permanently lose your sense of smell. It's important to know that many supplements can interact with medications, especially blood thinners and certain cancer treatments. Always check with your healthcare team before starting a new supplement. Finally, there's a group that you should only use with caution. Antihistamines might ease sneezing and runny nose for a day or two, but unless your symptoms overlap with allergies, these medications show no benefit after 6 to 10 days of use. They also can cause side effects like drowsiness and dryness of the eyes, nose, and mouth. Also keep in mind that many medications contain multiple ingredients, like a decongestant plus a pain reliever. Read the labels to make sure you're not taking too much of any medicine. Extra precautions may be needed if you have high blood pressure. Carefully check the label of any cold or cough medicine, as some medications have warning labels for people who have high blood pressure or take a blood pressure medication. Or you may want to speak with a pharmacist. If you have severe or uncontrolled high blood pressure, don't take a decongestant. These medications narrow blood vessels, which can reduce swelling in the nose area and other parts of the body. This also makes it harder for blood to flow through a narrowed vessel, which can increase blood pressure. Check medicine labels for sodium content. Too much salt can raise your blood pressure. Now here's a short article that's interesting. Breathing polluted air may be linked to dementia risk. Regularly breathing unhealthy air, be it from secondhand smoke or industrial chemicals, puts you at higher risk of conditions affecting the lungs. A recent study raises another possible association: dementia and other memory disorders. The study, published in JAMA Internal Medicine, looked at nearly 28,000 people aged 50 and older from different parts of the United States. They were enrolled in the Health and Retirement Study, in which researchers followed the large group over time and measured a wide range of health outcomes of people in various living conditions. About 15% of participants in the study developed dementia, a group of symptoms affecting memory, thinking, and social abilities. Alzheimer's disease is the most common form of dementia. A number of factors, being a person of color, having less education, and earning less money, were associated with a higher risk of dementia. But so was living in a zip code with higher levels of polluted air. People exposed to unhealthy air related to farming activities or wildfires had the highest risk of developing dementia. Being near vehicle exhaust in places where coal is burned also increased risk. Researchers don't yet understand exactly why air pollution may increase dementia risk, and more study is needed to probe this connection. Mayo Clinic experts say that the study alone doesn't definitely show a link between air pollution and dementia. It also doesn't account for other important risk factors, including family history of dementia. While you can't control air pollution levels, you can take steps to minimize your exposure, like living in a smoke-free home and staying inside with the air conditioner on when air quality is poor. Other steps to lower your risk of dementia include regularly exercising, stopping smoking, maintaining an active social life, and getting enough sleep. Now we're going to turn to a section of the Mayo Clinic Health Letter that's called Second Opinion. My friends at book club were talking about taking protein supplements, and maybe wonder if I'm getting enough protein in my diet. The answer is, you likely are. Most people in the United States meet or exceed their protein needs. The goal amount for most people is 10% to 35% of their total daily calorie intake. The potential downside of getting too much protein includes weight gain and digestive symptoms. If much of the protein consumption comes from red meat, cholesterol levels may be affected, and the risk of colon cancer may go up. Getting too much protein also is a problem if you have kidney disease. The extra protein can cause kidney function to decline at a faster rate than would moderate amounts of protein. How much protein you need depends on your weight and somewhat on your age. The recommended dietary allowance to prevent deficiency for sedentary adults is 0.8 grams for each kilogram of body weight. For example, a person weighing 165 pounds or 75 kilograms should get 60 grams of protein daily. To protect yourself from the loss of muscle mass called sarcopenia that often occurs with age, you may need more. Some experts recommend that the base protein needs of older adults increase to 1 to 1.2 grams for each kilogram of body weight, so 75 to 90 grams for a 165-pound person. People in any age who regularly exercise also have slightly higher protein needs, but people of any age should avoid getting more than 2 grams of protein per kilogram of body weight per day. Aim for an intake of 15 to 30 grams of protein at each meal. A banana, a serving of Greek yogurt, and a hard-boiled egg add up to about 19 grams of protein. A 3-ounce chicken breast with 1/2 cup of rice and 1/2 cup of vegetables gets you about 25 grams of protein. An egg and bean burrito with a glass of milk is 28 grams. As you can see, it's relatively easy to get your daily recommended protein totals without supplements. There are people who may benefit from protein supplements due to health or dietary factors. The type of protein in these products can vary. Either a whey or plant-based product is fine, and it usually comes down to what taste you prefer. But look for these attributes. The protein supplement should be 200 or fewer calories, 2 grams or less of saturated fat, have no trans fats or partially hydrogenated oils, and have 5 grams of sugar or less. Question. I feel terrible after getting my last COVID-19 vaccine. My children are urging me to get another, but why would I want to go through that again? It's a natural reaction to avoid something that's been unpleasant in the past, but there's good news. Evidence shows that your side effects were likely due to a strong immune response to the vaccine. Rather than focusing on the negative effects, it may help to think of them as a sign that the vaccine was working well for you. A recent study looked at immune response marked by the level of neutralizing antibodies in the blood at 1 month and 6 months after people received a COVID-19 vaccine. At both points, the immune response in participants who reported feeling unwell or who had specific symptoms like tiredness, headaches, and chills was 1.5 times that of participants who didn't have any symptoms. The greater the number of symptoms, the higher the level of antibodies found. Common short-term side effects after COVID-19 vaccinations include fatigue, headache, muscle or joint pain, fever, chills, upset stomach or nausea, and pain or swelling at the injection site. As with other vaccines, these effects are generally not severe and go away within a few days. Side effects can be unpleasant and even derail you for a day or two, but they tend to be shorter, milder, and come with much less health risk than what you might experience with COVID-19. the benefits of COVID-19 vaccines, preventing severe illness, long-term complications, and even death, continue to outweigh the potential risks. Your healthcare team can help put this balance into perspective for you. There also are steps you can take to minimize and ease vaccine side effects. Consider taking a non-prescription pain reliever after the vaccine, and if possible, get some rest. To reduce injection site discomfort, use a cool compress and keep moving your arm as usual. If your symptoms don't improve, check in with your care team. And then just very briefly, there's a very short section. Herbal teas come from soaking various flowers, leaves, or spices. Although they are tisanes and not true teas, many still contain beneficial antioxidants, and they may have their own symptom-specific health benefits. For example, chamomile tea is known to help with sleep. Ginger tea may have some benefits for nausea, and lavender tea is calming for some people. Be aware of potential pollen-related allergic reactions or interactions with some medications when you drink herbal tea. Well, it looks like we've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm Dr. Scott Youngkin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.